A little more than approaching halfway through chapter 16. This chapter 16 is a continuation of the pastime that is being relayed in chapter 15 and even prior to that. Because in chapter, I think it was 13, the demigods had approached Lord Brahma and asked Brahma why the universe had become so dark all of a sudden. And Brahma described how two powerful personalities had entered into the womb of Diti, the wife of Kasyapa Muni. Then, that was chapter 13, and then 14, the pregnancy of Diti by Kasyapa is described, and how due to the inauspicious time of that pregnancy, very powerful yet demonic personalities entered the womb. Now where did these powerful personalities come from? That's described in chapter 15 and chapter 16. So we heard how Brahma described how the four Kumaras were traveling. They had the potency due to their purity. They were jnanis. They had no connection, practically speaking, with their bodies. They understood that they were eternal souls. Just imagine how much anxiety would immediately be vanquished from our consciousness if we understood that we are eternal souls, if we actually understood that. We can list all the things that we worry about and our mind goes over and over and over again, day after day. What about this? How about that? If this happens, I'm going to do this, and if that happens, I'll do that. Day after day, the mind just goes over these things, and generally speaking, they are all connected to the body, to the temporary, to our temporary identity. The Kumaras were beyond that. Their consciousness was established in equanimity, and they were on the Brahman platform, thinking themselves or understanding that they were spirit, aham brahmasmi, and not differentiating between the Supreme Spirit and themselves. So therefore it is said they were on the Brahman platform. But they did not know the actual identity of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So they were unrestricted, because if one is actually in, gives up the identification with the body, we generally think of the body, the identification, or we think of ourselves as the body, and we think of the body as the source of our pleasure. The body through the mind. We identify with the mind, and the mind practically forces us to identify with the body. And we try to get our pleasure from this. And we, when we look at the body, we comb it and we dress it and we perfume it. Because this is the source of our pleasure in the mind of a materialistic person. But actually, it is that which restricts our pleasure. We're longing for unlimited pleasure, but we are trapped within the confines of the body. And therefore, it is like being in prison, jail for the soul. He's just dreaming of different enjoyments that he wishes were his. If you've ever, I recently visited the Fremantle prison for a slideshow. Maybe we'll try to show this one this weekend about jail. Maybe. And sometimes the prisoners, they'll paint pictures, paintings, sometimes quite nice paintings on the inside of their cells. But yet it's so sad and depressing because they are locked within such small rooms, they're confined, their freedom is taken away, and all they can do is dream of pleasure and try to paint it on in their cell walls. So we are like that, dreaming of pleasure while trapped within the material bodies. So the Kumaras, free from that, on the Brahman platform, could travel unrestrictedly anywhere, everywhere. And once, as they were traveling according to their will to the Vaikuntha planets, and then in the 15th chapter, the description of the Vaikuntha planets is given. So wonderful. Sweet. It is everything that we were always looking for. So sweet. Everything from the peace and the harmony to the fragrance of the flowers and the chirping of the birds. Everything wonderful. And it describes, there's a reference to Tulsi Devi, how all the other flowers that are so fragrant, they acknowledge the supremacy of Tulsi Devi. And later on, when the Kumaras get there, we see some of the potency of Tulsi Devi. That the Kumaras were decided, they are very enthusiastic to see Lord Narayan, the Lord of Vaikuntha. And they passed through one gate after another, and then finally they were blocked from entering the final gate to the palace of Lord Narayan by the two gatekeepers, Jai and Vijay, and they became furious. How is it possible, they were saying, that there's a need to block someone from entering the spiritual world? We are here already, that means we have no sin, we are pure. Are we enemies or something? How is it possible that this duality, because they were fixed in oneness, how is it possible this duality, this consciousness of duality has entered the minds of the gatekeepers? You're thinking that we could be enemies? Therefore, I think you are enemies, the Kumaras said. And therefore, because your consciousness is reflecting upon us, your fault, and you think we don't belong in the spiritual world, therefore it's clear that you don't belong in the spiritual world. We curse you. Go. Fall. Fall down to the material world. And the two gatekeepers were so frightened, they begged them, please, we will accept your curse, we did wrong, but please don't let us forget the Lord. Because this point comes up again and again, that this is actually the essence of the difference between material life and spiritual life. In spiritual life, in the spiritual world, Goloka Vrindavan, Vaikuntha, everyone's consciousness is focused on Krishna and deep and loving remembrance. If one is in the material world, but his consciousness is focused on loving remembrance, continuous loving remembrance of Krishna, he's actually in the spiritual world. So they said, we don't mind being in the material world as long as we can focus our consciousness on Krishna. This is actually the essence of all advice. Etya eva kinkara. And then, immediately after the cursing of the two gatekeepers, Lord Narayan himself came. Although he had Garuda right there, he came practically running on his two lotus feet with Lakshmi Devi. And when the four Kumaras saw him, they were completely charmed by his beautiful countenance. Everything about him was wonderful. They were shocked. Their minds were disturbed. The Tulsi, where was the Tulsi Devi? Tulsi was at the lotus feet of the Lord. And the breeze carrying that aroma of Tulsi Devi and the mixed with the lotus feet of the Lord, his fragrance, it drifted to the nostrils of the four Kumaras. And their minds, which previously had been fixed in sameness and equanimity, was disturbed, agitated, something that could not happen by anything material. So this fragrance, everything they saw in the spiritual world, was on a different level, wonderful, wonderful level, so wonderful they had never experienced it before. Such a wonderful ecstasies. And they changed at that time. They shifted due to the mercy of the fragrance of Tulsi Devi. They shifted from being jnanis to being devotees. And they immediately began speaking to the Lord. They spoke five very wonderful verses saying that you are the Supreme Absolute Truth. It is not that Brahman is there and you're a manifestation of illusion. No, you are the Supreme Absolute Truth. We previously heard about this from our father, Lord Brahma. Now we're experiencing it. And what is it that we have done to allow us to see you? They say, it is only your mercy, because there is no other way. There is nothing a living entity can do on his own to see the Supreme Lord. He can act in a qualified and wonderful way to attract the causeless mercy of the Lord, but in and of himself he cannot do not do anything. And after seeing the Lord, they said, previously we thought we had already given up, because they were jnanis, so they had given up all thoughts that material happiness could bring pleasure. Material pleasure could bring actual happiness. But now they were looking at liberation also as insignificant, and they cared nothing for it. And that's the goal of the jnanis, those fixed in Brahman realization. And rather, what did they like now? They said, let anything happen. Let us take our birth anywhere. Let us take any hellish birth even. But just let us be engaged in your devotional service. Because for an actual devotee, that's all he cares about. Even in the verse in the ninth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, very important verses, apiche tudra chiro bhajate mamananyavak sadhariva. When Krishna says that even if my devotee commits a horrible activity, sudra chiro, very, very abominable activity, still sadhariva, he's considered saintly. Because ananyavak, he is fixed in devotional service. That means, and Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur reveals the mentality of the devotee that makes the Lord speak like this, that he's still my devotee, I declare. And what's that mentality? It's that the devotee thinks that for my improper activities, I will have to go to hell, I will have to suffer. And I'm not saying, but I'm a devotee, stop my suffering. No, no, no. Let me suffer. But I will somehow or another continue serving. So that's the life of a devotee doing service. That's because this is actually his life. This is the completion of his existence. So fixed in that. So the Kumaras say, for what we may have to take our birth in hell, because actually they were beginning to realize they had made a mistake in cursing the giant Vijay. But please, O Lord, let us always be engaged in your service. And they were so satisfied to see the eternal form and the opulences of the Lord. They weren't. They were jnanis. So the jnanis, they look at the material world, they see it as false. When the Kumaras saw the Lord and his opulence and the opulences of Vaikuntha, rather than thinking that they were false, they were completely satisfied. So this shows that the spiritual world is eternal and real, and the Kumaras, all they could and would do was offer their humble obeisances. They were so satisfied. So then, after the Kumaras offered their first time they saw the Lord, Then Krishna, so there he was, the Lord was there, and the Kumaras were there, completely enwrapped, enthralled by his beauty, and then he began speaking, and we may start thinking that he would be the way he would speak is,
"My dear four Kumaras, now you have understood me as the Supreme Person."
You know, in a very, very, very heavy and deep and reverential way, forcing the reverence. "I am, yes, you are correct. I am that all-powerful person who is worshipped as the Supreme. It is I who am the creator, the maintainer, the destroyer." But how the Lord responded was completely different. It was amazing, actually. He said, "Oh, my servants, Jai and Vijay, have committed a great offense against you by not allowing you to see me. And you have punished them. I think it is very good. I approve of the punishment that you've given him. Why? Because you are brahmanas. You are devotees. And because these doormen are my servants, because they are my servants, it is an offense. The offense that they have committed is my offense. And therefore, I seek your forgiveness for what has happened." This is the Supreme Lord speaking. "I seek your forgiveness because an act a bad act committed by the servant reflects upon the master. So please forgive me." He didn't even say forgive them. "Forgive me," he says. And then amazingly enough, the Lord says, "Now that you are devotees, I will even not hesitate to cut off my own arm if its conduct is found hostile to you." So he's starting to glorify, because you are great devotees, he's saying. "You are so dear to me. Because my devotees are so dear to me that I will even cut off my arm." And then he says, and this verse is, there'll be a response to by the Kumaras to the seventh verse. He says, "Because I am the servitor of my devotees, my lotus feet have become so sacred that they immediately wipe out all sin. And I have acquired such a disposition that the goddess of fortune does not leave me. This is due to my loving service to my devotees. I don't enjoy the food that is offered in sacrifice as much as I enjoy and accept the food that my devotees eat. I even take the dust of the feet of the Vaishnavas on my head." Then he explains that. So he's speaking in this way, that Brahmins, they are no different from me. The devotees, they are not different from me. They must be protected. The Brahmins, the cows, the defenseless creatures, they are like my own body. They have to be protected. So the Lord was speaking in such a wonderful way. And he says that when one sees a devotee or a brahmana, one should be so happy, that will please me. Even if the devotees or the brahmanas speak harshly, we should reciprocate with them with smiles and soft words. And then he finally says, they have transgressed you. So my only request to you is that you can send them to the material world, but please bring them back to me. Let them come back before long. So the four Kumaras were actually shocked, because the Lord was exhibiting his great, great affection by speaking like he had done them wrong. He was exhibiting his affection, his great amazing affection for his devotees. And they were very intelligent. And they could gradually... I won't get too far ahead. But they understood that they made a mistake. Because this is the way of dealing. That if you say to someone, you've made a great mistake, then immediately the natural tendency of the person is to say, what do you mean? I made a mistake. You made a mistake. Is to defend and put up all the blocks against hearing what the person is saying. But in this expert way that the Lord is speaking, He was teaching them a little indirectly. And in this way, without directly saying you have made a mistake, they understood it themselves. Krishna also taught in this way when He taught Indradev. Indra thought himself very, very, very powerful, and therefore he decided to inundate and destroy the residents of Vrindavan, Nanda Maharaj, and everyone, and the cows even. So he came, and Krishna could have said, I am the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he could have taken the thunderbolts and turned them back or sent them at Indra or created some demon to kill Indra or something like that. But instead of that, he let Indra use all the power that Indra could muster up with his storm clouds and rain and lightning and thunder. And instead of stopping Indra, he just let Indra do it. And instead of stopping Indra, he held up Govardhan Hill to protect his devotees. And was he struggling to hold up the great hill? No. Just with the little finger of his left hand, insignificant. Indra was using all his force, and with the insignificant little finger of his left, not even his right hand, his left hand, not even the strongest fingers of the left hand, because the left hand is weaker than the right hand. So just the littlest finger. In other words, just using a tiny, tiny, little, insignificant bit of his power, he protected his devotees by holding up Govardhan Hill. And then Indra himself understood, I have made a great mistake. Krishna is so powerful, unlimitedly powerful. And then he approached Govinda in a solitary place after calling off the rain clouds to apologize. So he understood it, and he said to Krishna, you are the best teacher. Because you make someone realize what you want them to realize themselves. And then when one realizes it himself, the realization is ours. No one can talk us out of it when it's deeply realized oneself, not theoretical. So the Lord's words were spoken in a way that although he was apologizing on behalf of his devotees, he was actually telling he was apologizing, ready to cut off his own arm. He was actually saying something quite different to teach the four kumaras something. So text 13. Even though the sages had been bitten by the serpent of anger, their souls were not satiated with hearing the Lord's lovely and illuminating speech, which was like a series of Vedic hymns, because the Lord's words were so sweet, they wanted to hear more and more and more and more. Because that is the nature of things connected to Krishna. Rather than it satiating or filling us up, rather it lights a fire in the heart, which demands more and more fuel, more and more Krishna's association. And the sages, well, the verses in 14, the Lord's excellent speech was difficult to comprehend. On one level, it sounded very simple. I'll cut off my arm to protect my devotees. Those who are dependent, I consider like my own body. I love the brahmanas like my own self. It is an offense against me because the servants have committed. In one sense, on one level, it was very simple and very clear and straightforward. But yet, the Kumaras found, because of their intelligence, they found it was difficult to comprehend because of its momentous, great import. and its most profound significance. The sages heard it with wide open ears and pondered it as well. Wide open ears. Because we can very often, of course, we can close our mouths, we can close our fists, we can close our eyes. But we don't physically close our ears, but we mentally can close our ears. When we are not eager to hear something, or when we are much more eager to think about something else, we close our ears with our minds, actually. But the sages weren't like that. They wanted to hear more and more and more, and they thought about it, what the Lord had said. And they understood that although hearing, they could not understand what he intended to do. They couldn't understand, as Prabhupada explained in the purport. They couldn't understand what they want, what the Lord wanted. He said, "Yes, send them." Just imagine if you had just said, "Get out of my house, never come back," to someone, and then the person who the Lord came in, and he said, "Yes, it is very good that you have kicked these people out of my house, out of your house." Actually, it was his house too, out of my house. You have kicked them out of my house. Very good that you have done this. But one thing, because I love them so much, my only request to you is please let them come back as quickly as possible. So what would you think? You'd think, uh-oh. He loves them so much, and he hasn't said your curse was foolish. And you've made a mistake. But by the way he agreed with them, he was telling them something. So he couldn't understand what the Supreme Lord wanted them to do, actually, because he spoke indirectly. Nor could they understand whether the Lord was angry or pleased with them. He spoke, "Oh, my dear Brahmanas, you are everything. You are so wonderful." But indirectly he was saying, "You've made a great mistake." The angry. So this is the nature of the Lord's wonderful speech, full of many meanings. But in any case, by looking, they were extremely delighted, text 15, to behold the Lord, to look at him, because he was so ecstatic to see. They were experiencing a thrill throughout their bodies. Their hair was standing on end. And then they spoke to the Lord, who had revealed his glories as the Supreme Personality of Godhead through his internal potency or Yogamaya. So now the sages, the four Kumaras, reply. They spoke first, then the Lord spoke in such a humble, amazingly humble and deep way that it practically bewildered them. And then they are speaking again. The sages said, "O Supreme Personality of Godhead, we are unable to know what you intend for us to do. For even though you are the Supreme Ruler of all, you speak in our favor as if we had done something good for you." O Lord, you are the Supreme Director of the Brahminical culture. So now the Kumaras are going to glorify Krishna. And he's glorifying him. They glorify him for his qualities. Because they're coming from the platform of jnanis, from jnana. And the jnanis, their realization is that everything is one, undifferentiated oneness. Kaivalya, undifferentiated oneness. That means that there are no qualities. And now they are going to glorify the qualities of the Lord. Because in the Bhagavatam, in the progression, we are hearing it's interesting in this part, the leaders of the jnanis or the impersonalists, the guru of the impersonalists, the four kumaras, they will glorify the qualities of the Lord, showing how Bhagavan realization is still higher than Brahman realization, and especially in the next canto, in canto 4, there's going to be such a criticism of demigod worship, not a criticism exactly of it, but putting it in its perspective of demigod worship and fruitive work, etc. But here, the position of the jnanis is placed in its perspective by the guru of the jnanis who are describing wonderful qualities of the Lord. So the first one is, you are the supreme director of the Brahminical culture. So now we're going to learn something about Brahminical culture. You're considering the Brahmanas to be in the highest position as your example for teaching others, because the Brahminical culture is the culture by which one makes advancement. The Brahminical culture is the Vedic culture, because the Brahmins, the purpose of the Brahmins in culture is to make sure that society has a spiritual goal. And then based on that, the Kshatriyas rule. And based on the Kshatriyas rule, the Vaishyas create wealth by Krishna's system of wealth and the Sudras work. And this is how society works. But the center of it is the Brahman. Only the Sudras take over. Everything just goes down and culture is lost. So to teach others, the Kumaras are saying, your example is considering, your example in glorifying us, who they are the greatest of the Brahmins, because a Brahmana is one who knows Brahman. So your example is for the teaching of others. Actually, it is not us who are worshipable. It is you who are the supreme worshipable deity. Not only for the demigods, the gods, but for the Brahmanas also. So they are establishing Krishna as the supreme worshipable person. You are the source of the eternal occupation of all living entities. And by your multi-manifestations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you have always protected religion. This is Dharma. So the purpose of Dharma, Krishna himself is showing how Dharma has to be protected. And Dharma doesn't mean religion exactly. It is the activities. Dharma means that which sustains the living entity. And ultimately, on the material level, it's the activities of especially the vanashrama activities. And even on the spiritual level, that which sustains one is his service to Krishna. So you are the supreme objective of religious principles, and in our opinion, you are inexhaustible and unchangeable eternally. And yet, because they're coming from the point of jnana, so that speaking in jnani terms, you are inexhaustible and unchangeable eternally. So although you are eternal, although you are inexhaustible, although you are unchangeable, still you're a person. So it is actually, the jnanis generally make the fault of saying that the Lord, who is unchangeable and inexhaustible and eternal, can't be a person. But this is the inconceivable potency of the Lord, and the guru of the jnanis is proclaiming, they're proclaiming it here. So it's Krishna that is the worshipable object. Text 19. Mystics and transcendentalists, by the mercy of the Lord, cross beyond nescience by ceasing all material desires. It is not possible, therefore, that the Supreme Lord can be favored by others. The goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, the dust of whose feet is worn on the head by others, waits upon you as appointed, for she is anxious to secure a place in the abode of the king of bees, who hovers on the fresh wreath of tulsi offered at your feet by some blessed devotee. Purport. And this is, as previously described, tulsi has attained all superior qualities due to being placed at the lotus feet of the Lord. So when we When the Kumaras, when we heard the description of the Kumaras as they were entering Vaikuntha, and we heard about the wonderful and fragrant flowers that were there all serving the Lord, we heard about the queen of all flowers, who all the fragrant flowers gave all respect to, was Tulsi Devi. And then next, we saw the potency of Tulsi Devi, because just by smelling her fragrance, she was so powerful that she changed the mind, the consciousness, she elevated the Kumaras. So when we think of someone powerful, when we think of someone who has great power, we think of them being great, powerful controllers. But in devotional life, it is just the opposite. When someone becomes powerful, it is because they are servants. And so look at Tulsi's position and her power, because she was always at the lotus feet of the Lord. And listen, what makes her even more powerful than Lakshmi Devi? The comparison made here is very nice. As the king of bees hovers over the tulsi leaves offered to the demigods, Brahma offered to the lotus feet of the Lord, so Lakshmi, the goddess, who is sought by the demigods, brahmanas, and Vaishnavas, and everyone else, always engages in rendering service to the lotus feet of the Lord. The conclusion is that no one can be the benefactor of the Lord. Everyone is actually the servant of the servant of the Lord. Here it is in the next verse, in the purport. All the demigods and other living entities worship Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, just to get her favor. Yet the Lord is never attached to her because he can create an unlimited number of such goddesses for his transcendental service. The goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, is sometimes envious of the tulsi leaves which are placed at the lotus feet of the Lord, for they remain fixed there and do not move. Whereas Lakshmiji, although stationed by the chest of the Lord, sometimes has to please other devotees who pray for her favor. Lakshmiji sometimes has to go to satisfy her numerous devotees. But tulsi leaves never forsake their position, and therefore the Lord appreciates the service of the tulsi more than the service of Lakshmi. So what is the source of Tulsi's power and potency and her exalted position is that she never, ever, ever leaves the service of the Lord's lotus feet. So we're getting with the material conceptions that we are born with, the te dvanva, the dvanva, the dualities, that are in the consciousness of every conditioned soul. The illusion that is there is that I want to become successful by becoming powerful and lording it over the material world. And we're getting a conceptual transplant here, so to speak. We're learning something different through the Lord, through the Kumara's realizations. And that different thing is that the most secure, powerful, wonderful position is to become the servant of the servant of the servant of the Lord. Gopi Bharata Parakamalayo Dasa Dasana Das. No one wants to be a servant in the material world. And if people are doing service, it is just business to get a salary so that they can become masters. Master, power, enjoyment. That's what everyone is trying to do. But here, the principles that govern spiritual life are just the opposite. So it is very important for these to enter very deeply into our consciousness so they can root out the material tendencies. O Lord, You are exceedingly attached to the activities of your pure devotees. We use that word, oh, he's a pure devotee, this one's not a pure devotee, we talk like that. But we forget, or at least I forget, what does those two little words mean, pure devotee? It means servant. A servant. A person who is serving just for the pleasure of the Master, the Lord, and the Lord's devotees. Anyabhilasita sanyam jnana kamara. Oh Lord, so this is the Kumaras speaking. Their consciousness has been purified and turned upside down, practically speaking, by their experience in Vaikuntha. You are exceedingly attached to the activities of your pure devotees, yet you are never attached to the goddesses of fortune who constantly engage in your transcendental loving service. How can you be purified, therefore, by the dust of the path traversed by the brahmanas? And how can you be glorified and made fortunate by the marks of Srivats on your chest? Because if you remember in the seventh verse, the Lord said, because I am the servitor of the brahmanas, because I'm the serving the brahmanas, it is because of that that my lotus feet have become so sacred and pure that they wipe out all sin. And because of that, my service to the brahmanas, I've acquired a disposition that makes the goddess of fortune stay by me. But they're saying, no, 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 it's not because of your service to the brahmanas. You're not attached to the goddess of fortune. And we don't purify you. You are the supreme pure. You're unlimitedly opulent. The end, towards the end of Prabhupada's purport, he says, when the Lord says, therefore, that it is due to the causeless mercy of the brahmanas that Lakshmiji does not leave him, we can understand that Lakshmiji is attracted by the opulence of the Lord, not by the brahman's benedictions upon him. The Lord is not dependent on anyone's mercy for his opulence. He is always self-sufficient. The Lord's statement that his opulence is due to the benediction of the Brahmins and Vaishnavas is only to teach others that they should offer respect to the Brahmanas and Vaishnavas, the devotees of the Lord. So the Lord is taking this humble position to teach first the Kumaras, four Kumaras, and everyone else who has the fortune to hear. O Lord, you are the personification of all religion. Therefore, you manifest yourself in three millenniums, Triyuga, and thus you protect the universe, which consists of animate and inanimate beings. By your grace, which is of pure goodness and is the bestower of all blessings, kindly drive away the elements of Raja and Tamas for the sake of the demigods and twice born. So they're asking for a blessing because they, Rajagun makes one desire something, and then when one doesn't get one's desire, one becomes filled with tamagun. Kama esha kroda esha rajaguna samud bhava. So they're asking to drive away all this raja and tama, the passion and ignorance, for the sake of the demigods. And because we can't make advancement as long as we are filled with passion and ignorance. We have to be elevated to the mode of goodness, and that is the purpose of the Vedic culture. And this happens by your grace and blessings, they are saying. So please bless to drive away these inferior modes. We don't want them. Now Prabhupada explains this wonderful purport. And they were also aware that their cursing of the two gatekeepers was due to their, at least in the Leela, ultimately it was Krishna's desire, but it was due to their Rajagun Tamagun. Prabhupada's purport. The Lord is the personality of religious principles. In three millenniums, religious principles are protected by three kinds of spiritual culture. So this is what protects religious principles: austerity, cleanliness, and mercy. The Lord is called Triyuga in that way also. In the age of Kali, These three requisites to spiritual culture are almost absent. Austerity. No one wants to practice austerity. It's just the opposite. People want to be as unaustere as possible. Cushy. Live a cushy life. With as much, what's the word? Indulgent life. With as soft as possible. A machine for everything. A machine to open cans. Yeah, except they've done away with can openers now because, right, mostly, yes, why not? Oh, that was, yeah, when I was a kid, we had to work so hard in opening our cans. You had to take this little contraption and pull it to the top, and still in India, I'm sure they have, and then they turn this thing and in Russia. But now we've advanced so much, we don't have to do that horrible work, that hard, horrible, toilsome work. All we do is and you have an electric this and an electric that to churn the to make your lassi. You cannot use this primitive hand thing. So much work, you have to actually use your body for something. Why do that when you can push a button and why walk 50 yards to the store or to the temple when you can get in a car and go? And when you have a car, you never walk. It's true. So no one wants austerity. What to speak of cleanliness? What to speak of mercy? They talk about mercy. In Australia, it's a funny country because there's a great humanitarian, or not humanitarian, but the animal lovers. They're outraged, like when 500 animals die when being shipped to another country to be slaughtered, because they put them in live, right? So the animal, and then when they die on the way to be slaughtered, the people become outraged. So one time in Japan, Prabhupada, he saw the sign, it said SPCA. They have that in Australia, right? Or that means the society. They mean the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And Prabhupada said it means Society for the Promotion of Cruelty to Animals. They don't know. They just can't see. There's such a double standard. How is that kind to the animals? When you're shipping them to slaughter them. And they're outraged. They're not outraged at the slaughtering the animals at all. Because they're all a bunch of cruel, hard-hearted meat eaters too. No sense. So this is Kali Yuga. So these qualities, these practices are meant to bring us to the point of goodness so that we can actually take up spiritual life. So in the age of Kali, these three requisites to spiritual culture are almost absent. But the Lord is so kind that in spite of Kali Yuga's being devoid of these three spiritual qualities, He comes and protects the people of this age in His covered incarnation as Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya is called covered because although He is Krishna Himself, He presents Himself as a devotee of Krishna, not directly Krishna. The devotees prayed to Lord Chaitanya, therefore, to eliminate their stocks of passion and ignorance, the most conspicuous assets of this yuga. In the Krishna consciousness movement, one cleanses himself of the mode of passion and ignorance, of the modes of passion and ignorance by chanting the holy name of the Lord, Hare Krishna, as introduced by Lord Chaitanya. The four Kumaras were cognizant of their situation in the modes of passion and ignorance because, although in Vaikuntha, they wanted to curse devotees of the Lord, since they were conscious of their own weakness, they prayed to the Lord for removal of their still existent passion and ignorance. The three transcendental qualifications, cleanliness, austerity, and mercy, are the qualifications of the twice born and the demigods. Those who are not situated in the quality of goodness cannot accept these three principles of spiritual culture. For the Krishna consciousness movement, therefore, there are three sinful activities which are prohibited, namely illicit sex, intoxication, and eating food other than the prasad offered to Krishna. These three prohibitions are based on the principles of austerity, cleanliness, and mercy. Devotees are merciful because they spare the poor animals. And they are clean because they are free of contamination from unwanted foodstuff and unwanted habits. Austerity is represented by restricted sex life. These principles, indicated by the prayers of the four Kumaras, should be followed by the devotees who are engaged in Krishna consciousness. O Lord, they continued, you are the protector of the highest of the twice born. If you do not protect them by offering worship in mild words, then certainly the auspicious path of worship will be rejected by people in general who act on the strength and authority of your lordship. So, Prabhupada says something interesting, one interesting thing that I'd like to read that he said in his purport. In the verse it says that that one has to follow, that he's acting because everyone follows the Lord. Yadyara charati sheshtas tantani vetro dana. So because everyone follows the Lord, he's saying that you are teaching everyone in this way by your example. So Prabhupada says in his purport, one has to follow the authorities. Mahajano yinagata sapanta. Great authorities should be followed. Otherwise, if we simply depend on the scriptures, we may sometimes be misled by rascals, or else we cannot understand or follow the different spiritual injunctions. The best path is to follow the authorities. And the authorities base what they say, this is the Mahajans, the Acharyas, they base what they say on the scriptures, but the realized version of the scriptures, because the scriptures can be turned and twisted. So therefore, even though the scriptures are there, one must hear still from the authorities. And Prabhupada also says in this purport, one should worship the brahmanas and Vaishnavas by offering them all kinds of endowments and sweet words. And if one has no means to offer anything, he must at least use sweet words to pacify them. The Lord personally exhibited this behavior towards the Kumaras. If this system is not introduced by the leaders, then human civilization will be lost. When there is no protection and special treatment for persons who are devotees of the Lord, who are highly intelligent in spiritual life, then the whole society is lost. The word nanchati indicates that such a civilization becomes spoiled and is annihilated. The kind of civilization recommended is called Devapata, which means the royal road of the demigods. Demigods are supposed to be fully fixed in devotional service or Krishna consciousness. That is the auspicious path that should be protected. If the authorities or the leaders of society do not give special respect to the Brahmins and Vaishnavas, and do not offer them not only sweet words, but all facilities, then the path of progress will be lost to human civilization. And if it's lost, people will think progress as becoming more and more animalistic. The Lord personally wanted to teach this, and therefore he offered so much praise to the Kumaras. Dear Lord, they continued, you never want the auspicious path to be destroyed. For you are the reservoir of all goodness. So these verses are very much about responding to Krishna's words, which are meant to protect culture. Because without culture, everyone becomes degraded. Culture, what does it mean? What is its purpose? Its purpose is to elevate people in goodness so that they can take the spiritual life and use their human life properly. So the Kumaras are recognizing and saying that Krishna's words, they have many purposes, but on the basic purpose, they are meant to establish culture and to make sure that the auspicious path of culture, of devotional service, is protected and not destroyed. For you are the reservoir of all goodness. Just to benefit people in general, you destroy the evil elements by your mighty potency. You are the proprietor of the three creations and the maintainer of the entire universe. Therefore, your potency is not reduced by your submissive behavior. Rather, by submission, you exhibit your transcendental pastimes. So the Lord responded so submissively and humbly to the Kumaras. So if the Lord can act in a humble way, then guess who else should also act humbly? And don't worry about it. Your potency is not reduced by your submissive behavior. Rather, people appreciate it. But it's still hard to do. Even though the Lord does it, it is still hard to do because no one likes to swallow their pride. It's not a taste that anyone likes very much. This is the nature of the false ego. And the final verse we'll read, the Kumaras conclude. So after speaking on this level, saying how the Lord is just protecting culture and glorifying the Lord, what the Lord has said, and that he's not actually dependent on the Brahmins. He is the source of everything. He's not no blessings from anyone are required. He's on the other side, far from the material world. But now I get to the other aspect of the point. Oh Lord, whatever punishment you wish to award to these two innocent persons, or also to us, we shall accept without duplicity. We understand that we have cursed two faultless persons. Srila Prabhupada's purport. We should keep our ears open. This is a good one. The sages, the four Kumaras, now reject their cursing of the two doorkeepers, Jaya and Vijay, because they are now conscious that persons who engage in the service of the Lord cannot be at fault at any stage. It is said that anyone who has implicit faith in the service of the Lord, or who actually engages in transcendental loving service, has all the good qualities of the demigods. Therefore, a devotee cannot be at fault. If sometimes it is found that he is in error by accident, or by some temporary arrangement, that should not be taken very seriously. The cursing of Jaya and Vijay here is repented. Now the Kumaras are thinking in terms of their position in the modes of passion and ignorance, and they are prepared to accept any kind of punishment from the Lord. In general, when dealing with devotees, we should not try to find faults. In Bhagavad Gita also, it is confirmed that the devotee who faithfully serves the Supreme Lord, even if found to commit a gross mistake, should be considered a sadhu or saintly person. Due to former habits, he may commit some wrong, but because he is engaged in the service of the Lord, the wrong should not be taken very seriously. Earlier or in the end of the last chapter or in this chapter? Yeah.
So somewhere or other, I think it was in the Bible somewhere, someone mentioned that different political systems that have different Brahmins used. Like, they were kind of communistic.
Oh, yeah. Anarchistic. Feudalistic. Capitalistic, communistic.
Yeah. And I see that the Brahmins worked in anarchy, kind of anarchy. Because they didn't need regulation, they regulated themselves. So they didn't need a regulated body controlling members of the group. But, The Kumaras are saying that the Lord is the director of political culture, which means they have a director, or they have a minister of them.
Sure. But when the devotees say that, what they mean is, in relationship to what you're saying, is that because they voluntarily follow the Lord, therefore they don't need anyone above them. And if they make some mistake, they're not punished. Because they're self-regulatory. That's the point. It's not that they're unregulated. Anarchy means chaos. But it's not actually anarchy for them, because they follow. That's their whole business, to follow, because they're so serious about following Shastra, so they're regulated by that. But it's not proper for the Kshatriyas to be considered themselves above the Brahmins, because the Brahmins... But interestingly enough, very, very soon, within a few weeks, we'll hear when Kardama Muni, 2, 3, 4 weeks, we hear Kardama Muni's dealing with Svayambhuvamano. And when we think of, oh, the Brahmins are above the Kshatriyas or something like that, we think that now's a good opportunity for the Brahmins to crush the Kshatriyas. And if I become a Brahmin, I'll have no one above me. But when you hear the Brahmin and the Kshatriyas, Svayambhuvamano and Kardama Muni, speaking to each other, it's not the impression you get at all. There's so much respect and reverence for the other's service, that the service that the other is doing. But anyway, in direct answer to what you said, it's not that it's really anarchist that they act without any authority. Anarchy means there's no authority, but they, as the other thing that you said, is they follow willingly, spontaneously, and in a trained way, the authority. So, okay. Is there any more?
Yeah. You said that the Lord's words were like the Vedic hymns.
Yeah, like a, so sweet.
Does that mean that the Vedic hymns, they had, the word Ras came to mind, that the Lord's words, they had some, they were compared to the Vedic hymns? That means that in the Vedic hymns there's some kind of flavor that these Brahmins can experience?
Maybe. I hadn't thought of it like that. It could be the composition of the slokas were also